Alexander, good morning to you. Before you begin, however, let me check. Mr. Lewis, you are also here today. Do either council have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Then, Mr. Alexander, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Chief Justice Hadigan said, I'm Robert Alexander. I represent the appellant, Mr. Wood. Mr. Wood was convicted in the Hall County District Court of first-degree sex assault on a child. He was sentenced to 35 to 50 years imprisonment. In this appeal, we've raised 10 assignments of errors. Three errors we allege were committed by the trial court and seven claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. For my argument, I'd like to focus on specifically two ineffective assistance of counsel claims. The failure of trial court or the trial counsel to request a lesser included instruction of attempted sex assault, first degree on the child, and trial counsel's failure to object to Exhibit 18 and the corresponding testimony from Ms. Young regarding the discovery of male DNA on the swab of SM's external genitalia.
What do we have in the record regarding defense trial counsel's reasons, if any, for doing that?
For the jury instructions?
For either issue.
Nothing.
And how do we reach that at this point?
Well, on the, I think on the DNA, it's clear from State v. Johnson, which, if I remember correctly, was decided 2015, that that evidence, inconclusive DNA results, are irrelevant and cannot be admitted.
I think sort of since then, made that not quite as definitive as the Johnson case, haven't we?
I think if you're referring to the Saeed case, there's opening the door, but the defense counsel never opened the door in this situation. Also, something that kind of distinguishes is different from Johnson's. Johnson, there's a partial profile. In this case, the DNA was even weaker. There was no profile at all. In fact,
you're, in essence, you're advocating that this is one of those extremely rare cases that we can reach ineffective assistance of trial counsel without knowing what trial counsel's thinking was.
Yes, I see no reason why he would allow in Exhibit 18 or the testimony that male DNA was found on this 8-year-old's external genitalia. I mean, when you look at the state's closing argument, the transition to DNA, you see how damaging that is.
That's made with the assumption that we agree with your interpretation that this is now it's the same as the Johnson case, correct? If we disagree that this DNA information is the same as that in the Johnson case, then there would be no error on his part, is that correct?
If this court, I think to say that this DNA evidence is appropriate and Johnson was not, I think would essentially overturn Johnson. Because Johnson, his court made this statement that if statistical analysis is not provided, it's irrelevant because it doesn't allow the trier of fact to determine if the defendant was the source of the sample or was not the source of the sample. And because of the weight or the strength of DNA, it's more likely to mislead the jury and be more damning than it is relevant. So I think that
why wouldn't it be relevant to this type of issue if there was male DNA found in the location it was found here?
I guess I don't understand why it'd be more relevant than in Johnson was like, well, this person might be the source and this person might not be the source.
It's clear here that this is an unidentifiable male source, correct?
Yes.
And that would not be relevant to a determination of the situation?
The other part of the Johnson analysis was even if there is some relevance, it's unfairly prejudicial due to the weight the jury would assess to that and the likelihood of it being the DNA being misused by the jury. So even if there is some slight relevance, this court in Johnson even said a partial profile substantially, it was more prejudicial than it was beneficial for the jury.
In Johnson, didn't they say something like Well, there's a couple of alleles that were the same.
Yes.
What did something like that came up when that actually is a misstatement of DNA evidence, the use of DNA evidence to begin with?
No, I remember there's statements that there were some alleles that there's testimony saying, yeah, it matched up some, but I'm not exactly sure if it is a complete misstatement or not. I haven't had to deal with DNA for a substantial period of time. And since I wasn't the trial counsel on this, I fortunately didn't have to read as much into expected DNA testimony. I was lucky to be limited to the record.
I beg your pardon. I do have a question, and there's a number of variables with respect to DNA, and do they matter for our analysis? In other words, does it matter what is the nature of the biologic material? Does it matter where it was found, for example, on another human being as opposed to an inanimate object? How do you answer those questions, and are they relevant even?
I guess when it comes to an inanimate object, you look at the underwear. Mr. Wood's DNA was found on that. And in that case, they were able to determine that it was touch DNA. I guess the other area that came up in this case that would matter in the analysis is that there's no determination that this male DNA that was found was semen or any other biological fluid. We don't know if this male DNA is just touch DNA. I think there's testimony that her underwear, she took a shower, her underwear's on the bathroom floor. Did DNA get there because she used the same bathroom as he did, or slept in a bed that's used by the house? So I think it could play a part. I think if it was semen, there'd be a stronger argument for that. But in this case, we don't know what it is.
It was actually determined it was not semen, wasn't it?
I guess that is true. Miss Young did testify that she found no semen anywhere on any of the samples. I guess when you think about prejudice of this testimony, it's very obvious. And I think the damaging and how prejudicial it can be is the state's closing. She transitioned to DNA and says, makes the defense basically eat the words of his cross. And yeah, maybe in 100 years, we'll know more of what's on there. But what we know right now is that there's male DNA on SM's external genitalia, and there shouldn't be male DNA on there. And we know that Mr. Wood's DNA is on her underwear.
I think that's the exact danger of DNA evidence, when we can't conclude or give a jury any idea of the likelihood of the person who is the source of that to misuse it. There's no more question on DNA. I'd like to move on to the jury instructions.
Moving on to the jury instructions, do you think it's fair to read the record to believe, so we can determine what the trial strategy was of the defense counsel?
I guess when I think of the trial counsel strategy on this case, I guess you can't really read the record and know exactly what their trial strategy was. But what we do know is this: Mr. Woods facing mandatory minimum 15 years to life, while an attempt takes it down to a 1 to 50. And that I believe there's disturbing testimony by SM. However, then there's a lot of testimony from Mr. Woods' expert that would show that there was no type of penetration. So I guess trial counsel could have had a strategy to go all for nothing, but that seems to be a huge risk in the case that carries a possible penalty of life. I mean, for example, if Mr. Wood was convicted of attempted sex assault instead of first degree assault and got the exact same sentence, he would have been parole eligible in 17 and a half years instead of 25 years.
So if there is a possible strategy, don't we need to hear from defense counsel before we would determine that defense counsel was his conduct was deficient.
Yes. I would agree with that statement. I just don't see how, why a seasoned individual would not have got a lesser included, or at least put in the record saying, we don't want the lesser included.
From their arguments in closing, it was, the position was my client didn't do it, wasn't it?
Yes.
And discrediting the victim throughout the process to say, you shouldn't believe the victim because of these inconsistencies that were pointed out. And my client denies it and should not be held accountable for something they did not do.
Yes, but without a lesser included instruction, there's nothing else to argue.
Doesn't that potentially run the risk of my client didn't do it, but he could still be convicted of something?
Yes, and I think the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court kind of points out in back of the necessity to have the third option, because there's disturbing testimony. And if there's any question about one element not being proved, in this case, penetration, a jury is more likely to side on conviction to remove someone from the public who they deem might be dangerous. So, I mean, I guess that kind of theory has been addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's still said, let's look at having a third option. See, my time's out. There's nothing further. I'd ask the court to set aside the conviction and set it for reverse for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wiss, good morning to you.
May it please the court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellate of the state of Nebraska. What has raised four overarching claims on appeal. The appellant has begun with the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, so I'll do the same. The appellant's focused on the trial counsel's failure to object to the state's DNA evidence and trial counsel's failure to request a lesser included instruction. I'll address the same two claims. As far as trial counsel's failure to object to the state's DNA evidence, I guess first and foremost, we don't necessarily agree with the appellant that the evidence in this case would have run afoul of State v. Johnson, but for the sake of argument here, we would maintain that Wood can't show prejudice on this claim, because even if he could have excluded some evidence under Johnson or on confrontation grounds, as he suggests, there was still a large amount of properly admitted evidence which pointed to his guilt in this case, including his DNA being found on the victim's underwear, SM's testimony, the testimony of SM's mother, the testimony of the pediatrician who examined SM, as well as the defendant's statements to police when he was interviewed.
So your argument is the record is sufficient to address the claim and that it loses on the prejudice?
Correct. Yes, we would submit that this evidence viewed collectively is sufficient to conclude that there is no prejudice on this claim. There's not a reasonable probability that had that evidence been kept out, that the result of the trial would have been different in this case. But I don't think that would have been. The evidence was overwhelming.
With regard to your first comment you made, you don't believe that this falls under the Johnson scenario. Why is that?
Well, as you pointed out, in Johnson, the problem we had was that you had complicated evidence. You had alleles there, some of which matched, some of which didn't. And ultimately, the conclusion in Johnson from the forensic analyst there was that, well, he might be included, but he might not be. We can't include him, but we can't exclude him. And so that was the rub. And when we look at what happened in this case, we have the state's expert saying, well, okay, we had a DNA profile that was the female and he's excluded from that. We did detect male DNA, but upon further examination, no male DNA profile could be generated. And then we went and did YSTR testing. And again, no male DNA profile could be generated. So I would submit that taking all of all this evidence taken all together indicates he's effectively excluded, or at least close to it. It's not a problem with Johnson where we're saying, hey, we've got conflicting DNA evidence, or at least some things that are uninterpretable and we can't exclude it. I mean, that was outright stated in Johnson. We don't have that problem here. So I don't think that what we have here would necessarily run afoul of Johnson. But again, I guess in my view, the easier and cleaner route would just be no prejudice, because for the sake of argument, even if some of that had been excluded, that's far less compelling than the evidence we do have admitted in this case and was properly admitted, including his DNA being found on the victim's underwear. So taking all of the properly admitted evidence together, we would submit there's not a reasonable probability, had that been excluded, that he wins in this case. As far as trial counsel's failure to request a lesser included instruction on attempted first degree sexual assault, we maintain that we cannot show deficient performance or prejudice on this claim. He can't show deficient performance because the evidence did not warrant an instruction on the lesser included offense of attempt. So trial counsel was not deficient for seeking that instruction. And he can't show prejudice because even if an instruction on attempt had been given, there's not a reasonable probability that the jury would have found him guilty of attempt in light of all the evidence, especially when there was no evidence or argument to that effect at trial. So we would maintain he can't show deficient performance or prejudice. Just briefly, as far as the Beck case that, that the appellant points to in brief and again here today, first of all, Beck itself does go on to note that there is no constitutional requirement that lesser included instructions be given. And more importantly, it goes on to point out that several times that lesser included instructions are to be given only if the evidence warrants it. In this case, it didn't. So to the extent they're suggesting that under Beck, a lesser included instruction just categorically has to be given, that's not the case. The evidence has to be there to support it. In this case, it didn't. There was no evidence that he attempted to commit this sexual assault, but just didn't get it done. He denied that anything happened when he spoke with the police, and their argument all along at trial was that he didn't do it. So there was never any evidence nor any theory of attempt in this case. We would submit that it was not warranted, and there would have been no basis to request it anyway. As far as the other three overarching claims, I'm happy to walk through those if the court has any questions. I don't want to waste your time if you don't. But I'm prepared to address any of those three claims regarding the DNA expert, the attempt to refresh the recollection of SM, or the attempt to impeach Matt Price, if you have any questions on the claims. But if not, I can
what,
go ahead.
What Alcor statements was the appellant attempting to impeach of Price's?
You know, I'm not sure. That's a good question. I went back through my notes to see if I had any statements from him, any notes of statements. I don't have any. There's nothing in the brief. There's nothing in the appellant's brief. They haven't laid out any statements that he made, let alone what effect they had or why it would have mattered to impeach him. So I guess that's the million-dollar question here is, even if there could have been some right to do it, what would have mattered? I don't know.
Were any of the statements in dispute?
Not to my knowledge. I don't believe there was any objection to the statements. They just attempted to bring in his prior record when they were cross-examining the mom of the victim and point out that Mr. Price had a prior conviction, at which point the state objected and was sustained.
If none of his statements were in dispute, would his credibility have been relevant?
I don't think that it was relevant, especially since he wasn't there as a witness. I mean, when you look at impeachment of this nature, Rule 609 specifically provides that a prior conviction may be used to attack the credibility of a witness if such evidence is elicited from him or established by public record during cross-examination. The plain language of the rule suggests that the witness must be present at trial in order for this rule to apply. That's when you would be attacking their credibility, if they are a witness and present, and he wasn't. So we don't believe that his credibility ever was at issue through the statements or through any testimony, since he didn't show up and appear as a witness. So we would submit that Rule 609 controls here, not 27-806, which the appellant has pointed to. And we believe that the district court's ruling was correct on that matter. I don't see how it would have mattered anyway, because I don't even know what the statements were. They haven't discussed them, let alone what effect they supposedly had, but we don't see how it would have mattered anyway. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? We have no time for rebuttal. Thank you again, counsel. The court will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Dalton.